So our study tonight is going to be on Matthew, the 5th chapter. We're looking at verses 17 through 20. And when you look at these verses, I think they are perhaps the crux, the turning point of the whole Sermon on the Mount. They either perfectly portray the position of the doctrine of Christ or completely muddle it in confusion. And I think we will see that it is the former tonight. And furthermore, it establishes exactly what Christ is teaching, what he is confirming, and it further explains what his mission is and was here upon this earth. So question number one, we're going to start, I think, with Trace. There are many denominations that try to incorporate Old Testament and New Testament doctrine under the guise of believing in the whole Bible. Why is the distinction between destroying and fulfilling the old law so important for Christians to understand? That's verse 17 where he says, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy but to fulfill."
To scratch the surface, I'm just gonna simply say that the old law was a shadow of what we have today, and the whole purpose was to point toward the new and better way that is Christ and His Church, and I think that's basically the overall message. I have a verse, Romans 10. Verse 4, but really you could do Romans 10, 1 through 13. But Romans 10, before I read, it's a good verse. "For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes."
Very good. Very good verse. Anyone else? Mark?
Well, there are many people today, denominational groups and so on, who say that we still need to keep the Old Testament. The Seventh-day Adventists are a primary group. You know, they meet on what we would consider Saturday, and they say that there are aspects of the Old Testament that we need to keep. And so I think that's the significance properly understanding what Jesus is saying here. Jesus says, "Think not that I've come to destroy the law or the prophets." And the context, of course, is that many people are in this crowd whispering, and they made their Pharisees and Sadducees whispering in people's ears. He's trying to destroy the law of Moses. He's trying to destroy everything that we love and we appreciate from God. So that's the background. And so he's answering that criticism and saying that I have not come to kataluo, the Greek word to destroy the temple, same word is used of the temple when it was destroyed. I've not come to tear it down, but instead I've come to fulfill. He's not an adversary of the law, but instead, well, he wrote the law. He's God, of course, and so he loves the law, he wrote it. And I think the principle here is that he's giving us the full intended meaning of the Mosaic Law. He's giving us a new depth of insight into what God requires. It's a higher level of dedication than what was under the Mosaic system. It is the schoolmaster that has brought us to a higher level. We're now at the PhD level in spirituality. The Mosaic Law was a master's degree, you might say. And so Jesus is simply saying that I am the fulfillment of, really it's a grandiose statement he's making. I am the fulfillment of the law, and I am the arbitrator of what the law, he's claiming authority to be the sole interpreter of the law. So it's a sweeping statement that he's making. And of course, this is backed up by the rest of Scripture, and there are other places where we find that parts of the Old Testament are abrogated, or all of it. For example, Mark 7 teaches us that it's not what you eat that defiles you, it's what comes out of your heart that can defile you. So basically, Jesus is just showing us that he is the, and these aren't my words, I found these words, I thought they were great. Jesus is the eschatological goal of the Old Testament, and that's what he's saying. He is showing us how the law of Moses meets its true destiny.
Very good. I like what you said as far as grandiose statements. Jesus makes and subsequently backs up several of those statements. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the bread of life. And here I am the fulfillment. So, yeah, very good. Very good. Lauren?
Your second sentence in there says, why is the distinction between destroying and fulfilling the old law so important for Christians to understand? I like Kaufman's explanation where he likened what Christ did as paying off a promissory note versus nullifying the law, which would be like defaulting on the promissory note. And that made me think about Hebrews 10:12. But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God. So he paid the debt for sin. He didn't default on that.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't a bankruptcy. He paid in full. That's really good. I like that one. I think Matt, and then we'll get to Wes.
The trick is to get any of these groups that say that we need to keep the Old Testament in this New Testament era, the trick is to get them to apply that with any sort of consistency, really, because when they say we need to keep one thing, they'll say we don't need to keep another. I don't see any of these groups performing animal sacrifice, but they will apply it other places. And there are so many studies that we've done here that make this question so simple, but I can see where it would be complicated if you haven't gone through these books in the way that we have. The book of Hebrews, obviously, is incredibly, makes all this incredibly obvious. But Colossians we've done in very recently, and in Colossians 2, and verse 14 through about 17, he says, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he, which is Jesus, has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross, having disarmed principalities and powers, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it. So let no one judge you in food or drink, or regarding a festival or new moon or Sabbaths, which are shadow to come, but the substance is in Christ.
Very good. Wes.
You mentioned that in your view, you think of this as sort of a turning point in the sermon here. And it could be, I think it's an interesting way to focus on it. It could be that this verse is, don't think I came to destroy the old law, I came to fulfill it. It's sort of preparing them for some pretty radical things he's about to say. Right? He's going to say, you shall not murder. But let me tell you, murdering isn't just killing someone. Murdering is these other things. You shall not commit adultery, same sort of thing. Right? So he's about to say some pretty, maybe extreme to that crowd or that sort of mindset. But also, I wonder too if maybe he says that right there because he's already starting to see some reaction. He has gone through, blessed are the meek, these things that are easy to accept. And then he says in verse 11, blessed are you when they revile and persecute you. And you can imagine some people in the crowd going, wait a second, wait, what about eye for an eye? What about all of that? Mm-hmm. And so I agree that it's sort of a turning point, but I wonder if it is a reaction to the crowd or not a disclaimer, but sort of a warning, like, get ready, we're about to say some extreme things.
Like a buffer statement,
yeah,
almost. I think, honestly, it probably could be both, if it not is truly both. Because I think there's a specific purpose why he mentions it as early as he does. That I am not here to destroy. I'm not here to tear down everything that you've know about Moses and the law. But I'm here to fulfill that.
Bill. Real quick, I don't mean to keep going, but something I picked up in studying verse 17 and reading from different folks, I hadn't appreciated. And Bart kind of alluded to it. We're talking about if the Pharisees in the crowd and the Sadducees in the crowd were starting to murmur. Had they been able to make a clear assumption that Jesus was speaking against the law, that would be blasphemous. He could be killed for that. He could be murdered, put to death for that. Mm-hmm. So I hadn't appreciated that before. And again, it was important for him to talk as we touched on many times as being the fulfillment.
Absolutely. That's a very good point, because as we'll see throughout Matthew, there were plenty of adversaries that were waiting to pounce on that moment. Any other comments? One thing that stood out to me, it talks about here, he says specifically, I'm not come to destroy the law and the prophets. So he didn't come to destroy, but to fulfill. So I think we often look at how he fulfilled the prophecies, but maybe not as much on how he fulfilled the law. And that's what the book of Hebrews is about, how he fulfilled the old law as far as the priesthood is concerned, as far as the sacrifices are concerned. He's saying all of the entire thing, I'm the fulfillment of that. Very, very good comments. Okay, question, anything further? Okay, question number two for Lauren. What is a jot and a tittle, and why should their fulfillment give us hope? Verse 18, for verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law until all be fulfilled.
Well, for the first part of your question, part A, jot and tittles are small, subtle markings on Hebrew letters that help differentiate one letter from another, and they affect pronunciation. When I was researching the lesson that I had on Sunday, there was a lot of debate about these little markings. I think it was on the name Adonai and how that affect pronunciation and plurality, and seems to make a whole lot of difference in the way you read the word. Why should that give us fulfillment? Why should their fulfillment give us hope? The second part of your question. Well, so the law and the prophets point to Jesus, and we can take comfort in the fact that he is the Messiah since he fulfilled the prophecies written about the Messiah. So Luke 24:44. Then he said to them, these are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you. All things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me. And he opened their understanding that they might comprehend the scriptures.
Very good. Very good. That's exactly right. Any other comments on that? Bill?
I found a couple of places where, a couple of websites where they made the comparison, you know, jot and tittle, I think Greek and the Hebrew, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I know they're little tiny marks, but some of them were explaining, you know, think about the small case I without the dot. You know, think about an uppercase C with a dash that becomes a G, or an uppercase L without the bottom leg that is a lowercase L. And, you know, all those kind of things, I can put my mind around that a little better, not having a good appreciation for Greek or Hebrew. But then the other idea, you know, not just, and it's not just that every word is important. You know, what we're seeing here is that every letter in every word is important, and even every pen stroke, and even in every letter. You know, so you can drill down and go deeper and deeper, not just every word, not just every letter, not just every pen stroke and every letter is important. And for us, I mean, that's an indicator that gives us confidence in how important God thinks the word is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, even when you're thinking about even the tiniest pen stroke, every word, therefore, is intentional. If every small detail, every letter and every name, every place, every word and concept is going to be fulfilled, then every single one of it is intentional. And Jesus, obviously it's the truth, but he gives us further proof that this is indeed the Word of God. It's God-breathed. It's not made up by man's own invention. Anything further? Another thing I'll mention on this, something that I was thinking about, is what about when it comes to translations? I don't think we have a whole lot of difficulty here as far as whether we think a dynamic equivalent is as good as a word for word, but I think it's further proof that Jesus is saying here, even the very letters of every word are important and have specific meaning. It's not capturing the thoughts great, I mean, it's important, but you have to get it down to the letter. Just as a side note. Anything further? Okay, question number three for Malin. Has every Old Testament prophecy been fulfilled? Are there any Old Testament prophecies foreseeing the end of time?
This normally is not my area of expertise, so I guess I'll start out by saying I don't know exactly every Old Testament prophecy has been fulfilled. Most of them have been. Seems like all the messianic prophecies have been fulfilled. So I would say yes as far as the messianic prophecies. I couldn't find any examples other than I guess the second part, which is like end times prophecies, and that's Daniel chapter 12, and I think it's verses 1 through 4, the prophecy of the end times. I think that's kind of what you're looking at. There's perhaps others, and then we'll let somebody else speak about it.
Okay. Matt?
I have a question. We can come back to it if somebody wants to answer the question further. But Jesus says not one jot or one tittle shall pass away till all is fulfilled. If that fulfillment is the crucifixion, but we have specifically Daniel chapter 9 about the destruction of Jerusalem, and Jesus says in Matthew 24, this is about that the prophet Daniel, the abomination desolation, is about the destruction of Jerusalem. That prophecy would not be fulfilled until AD 70. Is Jesus talking about that here? It doesn't seem like he is, but how do we reconcile those things? I don't have a good answer for this. I tried to find one, and I'm hoping somebody, or maybe all of us, can try to reconcile this.
Okay. Wes.
Maybe an answer to that in Matthew 24, verse 14 says, this gospel of the kingdom, Jesus is speaking, says, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel. So he's talking about something after Jesus is speaking there.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
Yeah, it's funny. I was on the same track. I thought about this too. Obviously, the easiest interpretation is that he's referring to the end of the cosmos, heaven and earth passing away. But it is possible that he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple being destroyed. Mm-hmm. You know, Shahi and I have talked about this in Acts 15, when you have the council and they send out a command from the Holy Spirit about what Gentiles have to observe. That's specifically written to Gentiles. It doesn't say in the council what Jews have to observe. Right? I mean, obviously we know, as already been mentioned, Romans 14 says don't let anyone judge you. So that does affect things. But it's interesting that there seems to be almost a different standard for Jews and Gentiles. But anyway, it's possible that heaven and earth passing away may refer to destruction of the temple. And I just saying it should be listed as a possibility. And here's, again, from Matthew 24. Wes read from Matthew 24. Jesus says in verse 34, assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Right? So he says it's a summary statement, all these things, and it's cosmic revelatory language. The sky will, you know, the sun will be darkened, the moon will turn to blood, the stars will fall from the sky. So it's very cosmic and revelatory. And then he says in verse 35, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. And so you could look at that and say the same language is used here, heaven and earth passing away in the context of the change of the age. So the destruction of the temple is a definite and concrete moment where the Jewish rituals are over because the temple has been destroyed. And so I just throw that out there as a possible secondary. Obviously, we've got the primary interpretation being the end of the earth, the physical earth. Mm-hmm. But a possible secondary interpretation would be that jot or tittle is not going to pass away until the change of the age. And we know the kingdom was established on the day of Pentecost, mm-hmm. but God's official judgment against the Jewish nation occurred in AD 70, and that's a big deal. And then no longer was it possible for the high priest to officiate in the temple.
Right. The end of national,
yeah,
national Judaism. All very good things. I think, and one of the reasons I wanted to ask this question is because we often talk about, and we say it kind of offhand, and most of the time I think we mean it correctly, but we say, well, the Old Testament's been fulfilled, and just kind of close it at that. There are passages like Daniel that talk about things happening in the future, and with most likely probable conclusion being that it would be the end of the earth at the end of time. Any other further statements? My answer, or the conclusion that I kind of came to, I like how J.W. McGarvey put it, so it's not really mine, but you know, someone else's. He says, instead of coming to destroy either the law or the prophets, Jesus came to fulfill all the types of the former and eventually all the unfulfilled predictions of the latter. He fulfills them partly in his own person and partly by his administration of the affairs of the kingdom. The latter part of the process is still going on and will be until the end of the world. I like that conclusion and that explanation. So it's not, and in this sense, I think we can say that the Old Testament is fulfilled in the fact that Jesus has put in motion all things that the Old Testament said would happen. As far as all nations flowing to Mount Zion, Isaiah 2, all nations of the earth being blessed, that's an ongoing thing. So it hasn't been fulfilled as in those things are still going on. They haven't ceased. Even as the things mentioned in Daniel, specifically chapter 12. I haven't looked at chapter 9 in a while, so y'all are a little bit ahead of me on that. But Jesus, through his death, burial, resurrection, the inauguration of the church, has set all of those things in motion. That was the best conclusion that I could come to. Anything further? We'll move on. Okay. Questions 4, 5, and 6, they kind of roll together a little bit, or could overlap, and just want everyone to know we understand this. Landon, we're going to skip you, just because you're not feeling well, not because we don't trust you. Levi, care to answer question number 4, are there big and small commands in the Bible? Verse 19 says specifically, I got away from there. It says, whosoever therefore shall break one of the least of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven.
Well, we know that the Pharisee in Matthew chapter 22 believed that there were great and small commandments because he posed the question to Jesus, teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus replied, you shall love the Lord with all your God. Nope, that is not it. You shall love the Lord with love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. So Jesus answered what the greatest commandment was. And as to how it should lie to us, I don't really think we should say, well, that's a small commandment, so maybe God won't care, so I'm just going to do it. So there definitely is the greatest commandment, but as to small commandments, I don't think it should really matter to us whether it's a small or big commandment, whether we do it or not.
Very good. Very good. Right on. Any further comments on that? Lauren?
It's a matter of perspective of what tempts you as to what's a big and what's a small command. Proverbs 30, verses 7 to 9. Two things I request of you. Deprive me not before I die. Remove
falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food allotted of me, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of the Lord. So, you know, thinking about that, a poor person might not think it's a big thing to pride because he's kind of tempted with it. But stealing's, you know, in this example, stealing's a big temptation, and that's a big command. It's hard for him. And vice versa, you know, depending on what affects you at a time is what you might consider big and small. So they're, you know, I would say they're really no small.
That's good. I like that. That's a different angle than I thought about. That it kind of depends on where you're coming from as a person and experience as to whether you might consider something big or small. Very good. Anyone else? I think part of what he's trying to get across to the people that are there is the differences that are going to be between the Old Testament and the way that they viewed the Old Testament and what would be under the kingdom of heaven. The fact that they were making laws within laws, they were saying one was unimportant while one was binding. You can look at Matthew 23 as to what they were doing there. And I believe the principle that Jesus is trying to instill is that the kingdom of heaven is not going to be like that. There are not going to be least or greatest. There's only going to be those that do and teach. Because you look at the word for break, it says anyone who shall break one of these commands. That word in the New American Standard is translated annuls, meaning to break off from, to unbind. And it uses the example of a divorce between a husband and a wife. So anyone who breaks one of the least of these, who breaks it off from the rest of the commands and teaches men to do so, he's going to be called the least. There's not big and small, there's simply the whole. That's the conclusion that I could come to. Anything further on that? Okay, question number five for Bart. Why does Jesus use the phrases least and greatest to describe false and faithful teachers, verse 19, again?
Well, I found this the hardest question. And so I'm going to struggle a little bit with this, and we'll sit down and be excited to hear other answers on this. Whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments, so what commandments is he referring to here? The context seems to be the Mosaic commandments, which we know from the context in the New Testament are going to be aggregated, most of them, all of them, as we mentioned, the eating defiled food and so on. What is Jesus referring to here? I think if you step back and you look at it from the standpoint of the fact that he's speaking, as Levi mentioned, he's sort of summarizing, as Wes has said, he's going to give six examples in the following verses about how God has stepped up the level of service necessary in the church. And Wes mentioned a couple. There's more than physical murder that counts as murder if you hate your brother. Just looking at a woman with lust in your heart makes you guilty of adultery. So the level of obedience has been stepped up. Is he referring to this principle? I think so. I think that's what is being discussed here, and I could be totally wrong and be happy if somebody else has a different idea. But I think what he's saying is we're going to look at how if you disregard this higher level of service, then you will be the least in the kingdom of heaven. So that's the next problem then. The next problem is, what does it mean to be least in the kingdom? Calvinists say, well, there you go. You can be a sinner and do terrible things and not repent, and you're still going to be saved. And obviously, we know that is not the case. I think the answer to that dilemma is found in verse 20. So it sort of flows into verse 20, and he says, I tell you that unless your righteousness, for, which is a connecting verb, gar, I believe it is in the Greek, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So I think he's connecting this idea of if you don't obey the laws of the kingdom of heaven, then you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, I don't know. That's a terrible answer, but it's the best I can.
That's good. Further comments? Bill?
Well, I kind of got off on Bart's tangent too, this idea of this kingdom of heaven. That kind of messed with me a little bit, so I looked up that word heaven there. And that's not heaven, the realm of God. That's heaven, the, what did it say? Heaven, the universe, the world. So it's like, okay, that takes me back a little bit. Okay, I can maybe have a chance of wrapping my mind around this a little more. Earlier in, I don't know if it was 17, verse 17, and I don't know who I was reading from, but they wrote that Jesus knew the Pharisees were taking and dividing and prioritizing these laws. And that was part of, to their detriment and to their own advantage, tweaking these things to their own advantage. And this whole, we'll touch on it a little bit, this whole image of piety. But the idea that, you know, Jesus points out that those teaching such things in these ways, that those people would be labeled the least. And the false teachers leading others away.
Very good. Matt.
I don't know if everyone understands the gravity behind this verse, but this might be the most contentious verse in our brotherhood. We think, you know, later on maybe in this when we get to what Jesus says about divorce, but the interpretation of that hinges on what you believe about this verse. What does it mean? And how do we apply it? Mm-hmm. Because if you say, well, this means Jesus is saying that he cannot say anything different than what is contained in the law of Moses, you have a very different interpretation of what he's about to say in these following verses than if you take it as Jesus saying, what I'm going to do is not destroy the law. I'm not going to change necessarily this law right now. But I'm going to do, there are going to be some different things. And throughout the ministry of Jesus, certainly no one can deny, at least when he institutes the Lord's Supper, that's not in the law of Moses. But what this verse means is so important, and we obviously don't have enough time tonight to get into every aspect of it, but we can all do good to understand what Jesus is saying here and know that we can't take this entire section, but especially this verse here, lightly at all, because there are hundreds of people, thousands of people in our brotherhood that take this verse completely differently.
Agreed. Any other comments? I'll put in my 2 cents worth. Okay, so my 2 cents worth is when you go back to what Jesus was talking about, that there is no such thing, I don't believe, as a lesser command in the kingdom of heaven. Those that do and teach that a command is unimportant or a command is to be neglected, disrespected, ignored, whatever is least, so shall he be in the kingdom. So if he's saying that you can annul, you can take this aspect of the law away, and that's okay, the Lord says the same thing is going to happen to this person. He's going to be least. And the question I had to ask myself, take a step back, is in whose eyes is he going to be least in? Because if you look at the New Testament especially, but the entirety of the Scriptures, There's false teachers that pop up everywhere that teach things are important, that aren't important. You can do this. You don't have to worry about this. And there are people that follow them. There are people that give them a great amount of respect. So I don't believe he's talking here that they're going to be viewed less in the kingdom, in the eyes of men, but rather in the eyes of God. Now we know when once you become a member of the church, you don't... you are a member of the church. You don't have to be re-baptized. You have to be restored as one that is a brother. You don't cease to become a Christian. You become an unfaithful Christian. So they're still part of the kingdom, I think, but they are the least in God's eyes, and quite possibly you could even argue that they are, because of their falsehoods, cut off from the body. I think this is more a statement of punishment against false teachers than perhaps anything else. That's of course up to discussion. That's just simply the conclusion that I could come to. Any further comments on that? If not, we'll hurry through this last question from Logan. What was wrong with the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees? Verse 20, for I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven.
So for a much easier answer to a much easier question, this is basically a preview for chapter 23 we're coming up on, just addressing the Pharisees and rebuking them. The main problem, I think there are a couple problems. Bill noted how they would change the law and tweak it to their levels of importance. But the main problem here, I think, is hypocrisy. Jesus rebukes them many times for this in this chapter. I'll just read one verse, and then I'll sit down, because this, compared to the last question. But verse 29, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets.
Very good. Wes?
I think beyond prefacing chapter 23, I think it's also a direct link between previous verse 19 and then these verses that are to follow in chapter 5. Because, again, thinking about the audience there, the multitudes, Jesus says, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments, and people might be thinking, well, I don't break these commandments. I wear my broad phylactery and I have my, I perform and I have long prayers and all those things. And so he gets to that in more detail in chapter 23. But immediately after in chapter 5, he's going to say, here's some ways that you're breaking the law and you don't realize. Mm-hmm. Murdering isn't just murdering, the things that we talked about before. But I think this is a link, a specific sort of segue into the rest of the chapter.
Lauren.
I thought Logan was going to read this verse, but Matthew 23:23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Blind guides, you strain out a gnat and swallow the camel. Here is a comparison of heavy versus light. And the heavy, in this instance, is the intent of the law, mercy and faith and so forth, where they missed the purpose of the law, but kept it technically.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Got time maybe for one final comment, and then we'll bring it to a close. Anyone else? All right. So that's going to conclude our study. Some really good stuff. Obviously, a lot more that could have been said. I think we all recognize that and understand that. This is a chapter, but specifically these verses that are packed full of meaning. As brief as Jesus took to even say them, one could spend a very, very long time gaining all the meaning that he had for them. We never want to close